Welcome to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. I'm Sarah of the blog Sarah's Bookshelves. Each week, I'm talking with one bookish guest about two old books they love, two new books they love, one book they don't love, and one new release they're excited about. We're going to get real and sometimes a bit snarky about all things books. If you like the show, I'd really love your support. Spread the word to your reader friends, subscribe to the show, rate and review it wherever you listen to podcasts, or get bonus podcast episodes by supporting the podcast on Patreon. There's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio to my Patreon page. Let's get rolling. Hey, everyone. Welcome to our first ever Superlatives episode on The Big Show. If you remember back in December, Catherine and I did an Ask Me Anything episode to celebrate the podcast's 100th episode. I told y'all that we had gotten four buckets of questions and we were going to save one bucket for its own episode. So we are bringing you that fourth bucket today. And Catherine is here to help me with superlatives today, which is fitting because she and I do superlatives for the show's patrons almost every month, maybe every other month. We often do superlatives together for the show's patrons, and it is really fun. It gets very candid. It's one of my favorite things that we do on the show. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you. I love superlatives.
I think everybody does. It's kind of like a low-hanging fruit good episode.
It is, because you're mostly talking about books you love and books you've read, whereas our previews, we haven't read them often. And this is just a chance to be reminded of all the things you love about reading.
Absolutely. So, y'all, if you like what you hear today and you are not a patron and you want to hear more things like what you hear today, every month, all of my patrons get a bonus podcast episode entirely of superlatives. Each Big Show podcast guest answers five superlatives questions that I have written especially for that guest. And then I add in my own picks for questions where it makes sense later via editing, and I splice that back in to make the episode. And as I said earlier, you also get a lot of Catherine and I doing this together. Earlier this year, we even had an impromptu podcast strategy session during one of these episodes, and we aired it to all the patrons. And one of the things I love, and obviously this is not the case today because this is a public episode, but we're still going to kind of try to do the same vibe. One of the things I love about the superlatives episodes that go to my patrons is we can say whatever we want and not really worry about consequences.
Not really worry that my mother's going to hear this and be so disappointed in me.
Right. Or that authors are going to hear it, that kind of stuff. So y'all, if you're interested in that, you can sign up to be either a $5 or $7 patron of the show. There is a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio. All right. So we are going to run through just a list of superlative questions today that y'all submitted. And a lot of them were submitted by my patrons. And we're going to start with a very common question that bookworms get, but that I find very difficult to answer. Do you feel that way, Catherine?
Yes.
Good. Okay.
Really, almost impossible.
Totally. I almost punted this question.
Really?
Yeah. The question is, your three all-time favorite books and why? That's a hard question, right?
Very difficult. I mean, it's a wonderful question for readers looking for the best of the best. But when you read as much as we do, I don't remember. We'll give it our best shot, right?
Absolutely. All right, Catherine, kick us off.
All right. I'm going to kick us off with one that we disagree on. And that is A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles. And it's a big story. A Russian count is kept under house arrest for his entire life in the Moscow hotel. And Towles builds an entire world within the confines of one building. I found it mesmerizing and the writing was elegant. I loved it. It was total immersion in this marvelous little world. I loved it.
I did not love it. I can see the appeal though. Mm-hmm. It's one of those books that when I finished, I knew that it was a very well done book. I almost wonder if the timing was off for me as well, because it does take a fair amount of concentration. Mm-hmm. And it's long and it's a little dense. And I read it when my kids were young and I just was only able to read in very small snippets. And I always say that this is a book I might be willing to try again once I'm an empty nester.
Ah, okay. Well, my next two are both World War II fiction, but going way back as far as when these books were published. The reason they've remained favorites is because of the impact they had on me when I read them. And in each case, it was the first time I'd read about a world event from a different perspective. The first book is Skeletons at the Feast by Chris Bojalian. And it's about a wealthy German family heading west at the end of World War II to escape the Russians. It's the first novel I read from the perspective of a German family. I could not put it down, and there are scenes in it I'll never forget.
Ah, the good old days of Chris Bojalian.
I know.
We both, y'all, used to love him, and I did too. I have not read this one, though.
Oh, my goodness.
And just feel like recently it's churning out books that I have stopped reading them.
He's much more commercial.
Yeah, and he's much more thrillery now, which is fine if they're great, but I just, the last couple I didn't love.
Right.
I think I fell off the wagon with The Flight Attendant.
I fell off before that, the one about the woman who has sex while she's asleep.
Oh, see, I didn't mind that one. The Sleepwalker.
Sleepwalker. Yeah, that just
didn't do it for you.
Work for me. No.
All right. What's your third?
My third is, as I mentioned, still World War II, but from the opposite perspective. And it's Sophie's Choice by William Styron. It's about a Jewish woman who ends up at Auschwitz with her two young children. She survives and comes to America. And this is one of the most sorrowful, exquisitely written novels I've ever read. I love all of Styron's books. He's an amazing author. Everyone should read him. But there are so many scenes in this novel that are burned into my mind. It broke my heart. It's split between her time in a concentration camp and her time in America. And it's beautiful, but it is dark. It's the Holocaust.
Yeah.
Goes in other directions as well, and it is just some of the strongest writing I've ever read. So those are my three. Where did you land?
I feel like this is going to not be that interesting for a lot of people that listen to the show, because you could probably name these for me. At least one of them, I think. I'll start with that one.
It's a wonderful one.
Yeah. The Heart's Invisible Furies by John Boyne. And it's a recent one, too. Well, kind of recent. I loved this book so much because it hit the full range of emotions. It is horrifying. It's heartbreaking. It's hilarious. It's heartwarming. I mean, the writing is out of this world. Cyril, the main character, is one of my favorite characters of all time.
I love him.
He's just unforgettable. And then I obviously have to bring something by Pat Conroy, right?
Of course you do.
Also, not surprising. What might be a surprise is the one I'm going to pick, and that is The Lords of Discipline, which is not his most famous one. That, I think, is The Prince of Tides. But to me, this one's a bit tighter in his writing. It's not as sort of meandering and maybe sometimes could have used a little extra editing. This one is super tight. The plot is awesome. There's some suspense in it, and the writing is his beautiful writing about Charleston, which I love.
I don't think I've ever read it.
This is the one about the Citadel. Well, fictional Citadel.
Oh.
There's sort of a military college hazing plot line.
Okay. I need to add this to my list because I know I haven't read it.
Yes, you do. I think it's a bit shorter than The Prince of Tides.
Okay.
And my third one is Tiny Beautiful Things by Cheryl Strayed. I love this book. I didn't pick it up forever because I thought advice columns, that sounds really cheesy and weird, but it doesn't read like advice columns. It just reads like these very personal, heartfelt stories that even if you don't identify with every single story in the book, you will identify with some and you feel for these people in the others. And I just liked her advice she gave as well. It just felt very sane and well thought out. I give this book as a gift to people all the time.
I knew this one was coming.
Yeah.
Because you do. You love it. I liked it. I didn't love it as much as you did. I know, which is sacrilege that I should even say that.
It's okay. I forgive you.
Thank you.
Question two. This is along the same lines in that it's kind of hard. And that is, who are our auto-buy authors? Catherine, Who are your autobiography authors?
The authors whose books I read without hesitation are Anna Quinlan, which I know is no surprise because you love her too, Sarah.
I do.
I love her for her portrayal of women in all ages and in all types of life circumstances. Then there's Alice Hoffman for her stories, for her breadth of talent that she can write everything from historical fiction about the Bible to magic that passes through, 300 years of one family. And then on the lighter side, I would also say Kevin Kwan, who most people know him for his Crazy Rich Asians series. He just cracks me up. He's very snarky, very over the top, lots of satire. Doesn't always work for everyone, but for me, I'm always going to want to read what he writes.
Yeah, I didn't love Crazy Rich Asians.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. No, I can see that. Plenty of people didn't. It just hit me right. So
yeah, I know I'm an outlier on that one. That's one I always pull out of my back pocket of like a really popular book I didn't like when people ask me that question.
There you go. Okay.
So for me, the real answer to this question is I have so many autobiography authors at this point.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
I have a ton. You know who's not an autobiography author? John Boyne.
I was going to ask you, boy, I was going to bring it up when you said Heart's Invisible Furies.
Nope, not after that book he wrote after that. No, actually, I should correct myself because the book he wrote right after The Heart's Invisible Furies, A Ladder to the Sky, I also adored. Completely different book than The Heart's Invisible Furies. One of the best villains I've ever read about. And it's like a literary villain, which was awesome. The book he wrote after that.
Traveler at the Gates of Wisdom.
That one.
I haven't read it yet.
I'm not going to read it. I attempted it and then I heard other people talk about it and I was like, no.
Okay. Well, who's managed to stay on your list?
So I'm just going to reel off a couple. These are the first ones that came to mind. Know that my list is far longer. Anne Patchett.
Yep.
Tiare Jones. Love her. I feel like we're due for a new book from her. So I Googled around a little bit to see if she had something coming out. And I found some very distressing information.
Uh-oh.
That she took 6 to 7 years between her last two books.
Oh, she's a slow goer. Okay.
Which means we are not due for a new Tiare Jones anytime soon, I don't think.
Okay.
Her first couple books were closer together, but Silver Sparrow and An American Marriage. Silver Sparrow was like 6 years after whatever came before that. And then American Marriage was like 6 or 7 years after Silver Sparrow.
Hmm.
Yeah. But she puts out quality.
Yes. Yes, she does.
Meg Wolitzer also. She wrote The Interestings. Actually, my favorite book of hers is The Wife, which is deep backlist of hers and much shorter than The Interestings and has a nice little literary plot twist in there as well. And Megan Abbott is a go-to for me for slow burn suspense and demented high school girls and the dark side of female sports.
She hits so many of your sweet spots.
She does, doesn't she? And she's been a podcast guest, y'all. If you missed that episode, she came on this past summer. And then Britt Bennett, although she's only had two books. So can you be autobi with only two books out? I don't know.
I don't know. That's a really good question. I guess you can because it's your podcast and it can be what you want.
I will say, though, that a little bit different from the masses of people, my favorite book of hers is The Mothers, her debut.
I think I like The Vanishing Half. Yeah, I think I went the other way.
Yeah, most people did. I really like The Vanishing Half also. I just loved The Mothers.
Okay.
All right, moving on. Catherine's going to have a little bit less to say about this category because it is favorite audiobooks, and she's not an audiobook person, right?
No, not really. I used to be when I was commuting to work, but after COVID and everything, I don't listen to as many audiobooks.
But what are a couple of your favorites?
A couple of my favorites, and I think you and I are in the same boat here. When I do listen to audiobooks, it's nonfiction.
Yes.
Okay. So I have three. First is Smacked by Eileen Zimmerman, which I told you about.
Yes. You are the reason that I was able to have her on the podcast, and she was awesome.
That was a wonderful one. My other two are both memoirs, and both are comedians. So it made me think, do comedians just do an exceptionally good job of writing their memoirs? I don't know. But in both cases, these were hilarious with some very real moments mixed in. First is Girl with the Lower Back Tattoo by Amy Schumer. And the second is A Very Punchable Face by Colin Jost.
Yeah, I liked that one too.
Yeah. And in both cases, I mean, they're funny because that's just what they are. But they're also, they share their real life experiences in both these memoirs. And it's not always nice and good. I mean, she goes through a lot of body shaming, and they both have their own issues. But I thought they were both incredibly well written. Those are my choices. How about you?
So I got to throw out Tiny Beautiful Things again. Sorry.
Of course you do.
Just we'll get that out of the way. Cheryl Strayed narrates that herself, and she does a great job. Also, Untamed by Glennon Doyle, which you also told me to listen to.
Yep. I'll mention that later, but I haven't listened to it. I read it, so.
Oh, okay. I listened to it right in the like worst part of COVID when I was trapped at my house with my kids trying to educate them and work, and we didn't know as much about COVID and just life was scary. And she was just who I needed in my ears at that time. And I need to plug her podcast because she just started it within the past year. It's called We Can Do Hard Things. She does it with her sister, Amanda, and Abby Wambach, her wife, also comes on. I think she's been on almost every episode lately. Yeah, I think that was not the original plan.
No, it was just her and her sister because I've been listening since the beginning.
Yeah, me too. And man, it's like another therapy session every week. It's so good. I just love them.
I know. I do too. Oh, there's stuff where they're watching sports and Glennon
knows nothing.
Nothing. She calls it the soccer, the football, about the games. And Abby is, of course, lives and breathes sports. It's hilarious.
They're just totally different people.
Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways.
Which is so funny. I just love their relationship.
Me too.
But they are almost polar opposite people.
Yes.
And my last one, I've got to throw this out there, even though I have not even listened to this yet.
Oh.
But I feel like if I did listen to it, and I want to, I just need to find the time to do what would be a reread for me, is The Only Plane in the Sky by Garrett Graff. I obviously read it. It was so good. I had him on the podcast, and I've heard the audiobook is outrageous. You hear actual voicemails.
I was just going to ask you. Okay.
Yeah. They have the actual recordings of the voicemails of people calling from the planes.
Okay, see, I'm tearing up just thinking about it.
Yeah, in this audiobook. I need to go back and listen to it. I just haven't found the time yet, but I gotta recommend it even though I haven't listened to it.
Right, right. Oh, I bet it's amazing.
And I've heard, obviously, from people I trust that it's amazing too. And I think it won audiobook of the year it came out.
Oh, okay.
We're going to go back into our past now.
Oh, boy.
Yes, we are. First book that sparked your joy of reading. Catherine.
Oh, my gosh. This is such a great segue from something so sad to something that just I absolutely love. This one is very easy for me because I'm looking at the book right now. It's called Lori and Company by Eleanor Frances Lattimore. It was the first library book, a real chapter book, not a picture book, that my mother let me pick out. You would have thought I won the lottery. I probably went up and down the shelves in the children's section for 45 minutes and bless my mother for her patience. It's about a little girl being raised by a single mother. And it was the late 1960s when I read it. So I could hardly understand the concept. Two-parent homes, what do you mean? And it's not a spoiler or whatever. The father has died, but it didn't matter. Died, divorced. I couldn't wrap my head around it.
I bet at that time period, they would not have written a book where there's a divorce.
I absolutely agree because the book was written, I believe, in 1960.
It's more acceptable if the father died.
Right, exactly. But it's still about the mother having to work to earn money, and this little girl just trying to figure out her life and her place. And I mean, she's just a little girl, but I loved it. So Lori and Company, what was yours?
Tell you a little quick story, but this is not going to count as like the first book for me because I don't have a memory of it. It's just my mom told me.
Oh, okay, sure.
So when I was really little, my mom used to read to me before I went to bed. and she would read me Goodnight Moon, and she said I would grunt at the end of the book, and that meant read it again. And I did that like 8 times a night.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So that's pre-memory first book. So the first book I remember as a child that I did reread at that time and read it so many times was The Secret Garden by Frances Hodgson Burnett.
Oh my gosh, I love that book.
Yeah, I loved it. The mystique of the manor and the garden and
yes,
the house. And oh, I loved that book.
Absolutely loved it. Agree.
And then moving on, and actually, I can't remember the order that I read these, but Babysitter's Club was big for me. Flowers in the Attic series, anything by V.C. Andrews.
You're so trashy.
I am so trashy, y'all. And I want to make that point that, like, I became a reader by reading trash.
That's all right.
Jaws was one of my favorite books.
I wasn't allowed to read that or see the movie.
I pulled it off a shelf at a vacation home.
Wow. Look at you. Okay.
The same thing I did that with Nora Roberts, too, at a very young age.
Oh, and I don't think I've ever read her. Is she like romance?
Steamy romance. Yep.
Okay. Nope. I haven't read her.
Which books, if any, have you read multiple times or the most if you reread a lot? Neither one of us reread a lot, correct?
Exactly. And I'm going to add that I'm sometimes hesitant to reread a book I loved because it's like going back to a restaurant for a meal you remember from ages ago.
Yep. Might not hold up.
Exactly. It turns out to be disappointing. Who wants that?
Yep.
But I do have one that came immediately to mind. And sadly for your listeners, I'm sure I've mentioned it before, but it's Winter's Tale by Mark Halperin. And he was a go-to author for me decades ago. I own virtually all his books, but this is my favorite. It's just an epic story, a bit of fantasy based in Manhattan. And I reread it after 9/11 because I just wanted to be immersed in a magical Manhattan. So that would be my choice.
So I do not reread at all now. I just can't. I don't have the capacity to. But in the early days of when I wrote my blog, I went through this thing where I tried to reread one Pat Conroy book per year.
Oh, okay.
So this was around 2015, I'd say. So I reread The Great Santini, I reread The Lords of Discipline, and I reread The Prince of Tides. My two favorites that I reread were The Great Santini and The Lords of Discipline. I've also reread for work, let's say, a very few times when I had, this is way back in the early days of the podcast, I read I Miss You When I Blink by Mary Laura Philpott in print, and then I had her on the podcast a long time after it came out, and I listened to it on audio right before I recorded that episode to refresh my memory because it had been a while. And then From the Corner of the Oval by Beck Dory Stein, and that's a memoir about her time as a White House stenographer under the Obama administration. She came on the podcast as well, and this is like when I first started having authors on.
I remember that, yes.
The original plan for the podcast was not to have authors on. So this was sort of a tweak I made partway in, and this was in the very early days of the tweak. And so I read or I listened to From the Corner of the Oval a second time because a long time had passed between when I originally listened to it and when I decided to have the author on the show.
Well, that kind of leads into our next question.
It does. What you had mentioned earlier about you're scared to reread sometimes because you might feel differently. Our next question is a book you felt differently about after rereading. Catherine.
Yes. It's called The Longings of Women by Marge Piercy. And the novel came out in 1994. But I read it in the early 2000s. It stuck with me for such a long time because there was a character who is at midlife leading a very, I'll say, you know, upper middle class life and then gets divorced. And the downward slide of her life and how precipitous that can be just had me glued in. In particular, she ends up being homeless and spends most of the novel trying to hide this fact from people she knows. And it was so realistic that it just freaked me out because I think at that stage of life, yes, I had a career, my husband had a career, but you don't know. It just made me realize things can go away. So That's how I felt about it. I thought I would reread it. I reread it 2 or 3 years ago, and the plot with one of the characters veered in a way that no longer felt real. It just felt kind of soap opera-ish and even made the book seem a bit silly, which then I felt really bad about because I thought it was a unique and well thought out premise, but rereading it did not hold up.
Do you think it's because you became a more astute reader?
Yes, absolutely.
Because sometimes I feel like if you reread something, sometimes you've changed. Mm-hmm. Also, sometimes the landscape has changed. Like, you can't reread Gone Girl at this point. So much about Gone Girl was it was so new and different. And she was the first one to do a book like that, with that kind of twist.
Right.
And now they're just a dime a dozen, you know?
Right, right. It's not unique.
Yeah. So I don't have a lot to choose from here, but I do have one. And if you were listening closely when I talked earlier, you can probably guess what it is. It is The Prince of Tides by Pat Conroy. I still liked it a lot when I reread it, but I noticed some flaws.
Interesting.
It wasn't quite as magical as I remembered.
Really?
Yes.
I haven't reread it. I remember loving it when I read it. Okay.
So on the reread, I still thought he is just a master at writing about the Low Country, how it's beautiful and seductive, but it's also got this dark underbelly, and he just writes with such a nuanced perspective about that. And his writing was absolutely gorgeous at times, but at times it was really pretentious and overwritten.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
There were some sentences in there where I'm just like, what are you even saying?
I was going to say that felt like he was showing off.
Yeah, but then they ended up making no sense.
Right. Okay. That's difficult.
There is a book within a book in this book.
Oh, I forgot that.
Yes. I had forgotten that too, between my original read and my reread. I did not love the book within the book.
Hmm. That's a very delicate. That has to be handled well.
It does. And Catherine Ryan Howard handled it beautifully in The Nothing Man, I thought.
Exactly. That's the example I would use.
Yeah.
But it's delicate.
So there you go, y'all. That's shocking, I bet.
Wow. Yeah, I didn't think there was anything of his that you didn't care for or that you changed your mind.
I did not care for a book he wrote more recently, South of Broad, I did not like.
Okay.
It was his last novel he wrote, I believe.
Oh, I think I read that. And you know what? I think I thought it was all right, but I didn't love it.
Yeah, I didn't care for that either. All right, next question. Books that have had actual significant impact on your lives, a book that changed your perspective or taught you something important.
Wow.
I know. Big questions here.
Big question. I'm going to have to go with nonfiction.
I'm going with nonfiction too. I think this question screams nonfiction.
I kind of think it does as well. I can't think of a fiction book, but the one that stands out the most is called Inventing the Rest of Our Lives, Women in Second Adulthood. And I really feel like this is a case of a book finding me, not I found the book, but I read it after I had been laid off. And it kind of blew my mind. It lands in the perfect space between science and anecdote. So there's some warmth to it, but there's some real facts. The author discusses the scientific truths about what happens to women as our estrogen levels drop and how this massive change in our bodies and minds should not be perceived as an ending, but a beginning. And I guess I could count this as a reread because I do pick it up time and again. She blends individual stories with very real advice and options. And it made me feel that what I was experiencing was normal and being told to minimize or ignore it was wrong. So I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed this book. And I will say, if anyone is interested, it did come out a while ago, 2005, but it holds up. It's not, you know, time sensitive. And I did look at my local bookstore online and you can still buy it.
Oh, that's good.
Right. So I'm not talking about something out of print, but I thought it was absolutely kind of life changing.
I feel like I'm going to need this book.
You probably will.
Not yet.
Yes.
I'm imprinting it in my brain for the time when I do.
There you go. And my second choice, it won't be a surprise to anyone, and since we've kind of already mentioned it, Untamed by Glennon Doyle. I recommended it to everyone, including you. I bought multiple copies for almost every woman I know, and she just made me feel as if I had a voice. And if it was an angry one sometimes, that was all right. It's valid. So I think for women who are already in that space, they may think it's too rah-rah and self-helpy, but I highlighted more sections of text in that book than in almost any other I've ever read.
I didn't feel like it was self-helpy.
Good. I just know one person that I recommended it to, and at first they were like, I don't read self-help. And I'm like, I don't really think it is. But then they read it and they're like, oh, she's so kind of woo-woo and new agey. And I'm like, oh, well.
I didn't really feel that way.
I know.
Maybe I'm woo-woo and new agey also.
No, I don't think you are. You are the most straightforward person I know. So
that's true. I've leaned more woo-woo in recent years. I'll say that.
Yes. Life experience.
This is going to speak to one of my books I'm going to share, woo-woo-ness.
I was just going to say, what are your impact books?
So let me start with the woo-woo one. I'll tie that in right here. It's called The Mind-Body Prescription by John Sarno, and it's a book about back pain and how to get rid of back pain. And his whole premise is that a lot of it is emotional pain. And if you like just recognize that it is emotional pain, you don't even have to figure out what it is you're stressed out about, but you can kind of make it go away. Speaking of woo-woo and new agey.
Okay.
So I read that about a year and a half ago, and my back pain has not gone away entirely. I still have some flare-ups, but it has gotten massively better.
Okay.
And then kind of on the same topic, The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk. It's a nonfiction book about how trauma and childhood trauma impacts you mentally and physically later in life. And that was like light bulbs going off every 5 seconds.
You and I have talked about this book privately before, and I was recently in Barnes & Noble, which I shouldn't be, but whatever, and they had a buy one, get one free, and one of the ones I got was The Body Keeps the Score.
Oh, good.
Because I'm really interested, if not only for myself, but for other people in my life.
Yeah. Well, it makes you look at other people's behavior differently.
Mm-hmm.
Like if somebody's really acting out, you kind of look at it like, what happened to them? What are they going through?
Where did this come from?
Yes. Rather than like, they're just a jerk. Why are they doing that? You know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then the last one is Fearless by Dr. Pippa Grange. And Fearless is two words. And she's a sports psychologist. She also consults with businesses. And she has a philosophy on competing, which is the life-changing part for me. And her philosophy is, if you compete from a place of love and support and openness, it allows you to play freely and then get better results. Like playing from a place of fear causes you to be tight.
Hmm.
And you may not get the results you want. That's like really distilling it down to
interesting
two sentences. But I still play competitive sports. And also that comes into play with kind of podcast stuff too. You know, business competition.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on, a book that made you feel seen as if it was written for you, about you, or even subconsciously by you.
I love this premise. I'll jump in. I chose a novel because, of course, that's kind of where this is leading. But the format of this novel is so unusual, it might be off-putting to some. But I fell in love hard with 40 Rooms by Olga Grushin. It begins with the main character as a child being bathed, but is written with nothing more than the sensory perceptions the way a toddler would remember that sort of thing. It's not complete sentences, nothing. From there, it goes through this woman's life, each chapter being one of the 40 rooms she says we pass through in life. And it's about a woman with big artistic dreams who found herself being defined by others and the loss she feels. And what stunned me was in the latter half of the book, another point of view is introduced. And it throws everything she's believed about her life into question in a really kind of marvelous way. And I'm not going to say any more about the plot, but I still shake my head. I still think about that book and think about it in terms of my own life that, okay, are these things really happening the way I think they're happening? Or do I need to open my eyes or my mind more?
I remember that book. I didn't read it. Actually, no, I did. I tried it.
Right. And you probably DNF'd it.
I did. Yeah.
I might go so far as to say it's divisive. I don't know many people that were like, yeah, it's okay. They loved it or they hated it.
Interesting. Okay. It's been so long, I can't even remember.
I know. It feels like ages, right? I think it was 2016. Well, what's yours?
So it's interesting that you said this is leading towards fiction, because to me, this was leading towards nonfiction.
Oh, interesting. All right.
Yeah. And my pick is Tell Me More by Kelly Corrigan. It's essays, and they are organized around the 12 hardest things she is learning to say. And those include no, I don't know, I was wrong, and others. She starts things off with an essay that just spoke to my overtaxed mom heart very deeply. And when I read this, my kids were a little bit younger, and I was much more in the weeds in a different way than I am now. And then she also covers lots of sort of big life issues, marriage, motherhood, illness, religion, friendship. And I just loved how relatable she was and how irreverently funny she was.
Okay. I love this one as well. I think my favorite of hers is it Glitter and Glue? The one about her and her mother.
Yes. So I liked that one a little bit less.
Okay.
All right. Literary mysteries, y'all. Y'all would like to know our favorite literary mysteries, I think, because I've been talking about how much I love those these days.
Right. I sort of feel like you need to go first, Sarah, because it is a category or a genre that I hadn't really thought about until you started talking about it. I hadn't parsed books out in that way. So,
right.
What do you think about literary mystery?
So, first of all, I think that there is a difference between literary mystery and slow burn suspense. I'm going to divide my categories into literary mysteries and slow burn suspense. And I'm kind of going to just reel these off without saying a lot about them, because I think I've talked about these a fair amount on the show before. So literary mysteries, When the Stars Go Dark by Paula MacLean, The Witch Elm by Tana French, Miracle Creek by Angie Kim, The Current by Tim Johnston, Long Bright River by Liz Moore, If We Were Villains by M.L. Rio, and from deeper backlist, Mystic River by Dennis Lehane and The Cutting Season by Attica Locke. And then slow burn suspense, The Push by Ashley Audrain, Anything by Megan Abbott, The Plot and You Should Have Known by Jean Hampf Korelitz, Who is Maud Dixon by Alexandra Andrews, and then deeper backlist, Unraveling Oliver by Liz Nugent, Based on a True Story by Delphine de Vigan, I think. French accents are not my forte.
No.
And The Dinner by Herman Koch. Do you have any to add to that list?
I really don't, Sarah. I mean, I feel like you've covered it completely. This was one question that I was more than happy to say, and look at your notes and say, oh, okay, that's pretty much everything. So I think we can leave it there.
That's fine. We'll move on.
Yes.
This also might be this kind of question for you.
No.
Favorite fiction that involves a sport?
Okay. Well, it's actually an easy one for me. Maybe I recommended it to you. I don't know.
I haven't read this.
Oh, Sarah. Oh, my goodness. Okay.
All right. Adding it to the list.
It's The Falconer by Dana Zapnik. It so beautifully encompasses the dichotomy of a teenage girl who is a beast on the basketball court, outplaying grown men, but who is an outcast at school because she's too tall and she's a better athlete than most of the boys in school. So they call her a lesbian. The novel is so well written. I felt as if I was inside the character's head, and it was both familiar and foreign. You feel everything from her total joy when she's holding a basketball to the pain of being put in the friend zone by a boy she has a massive crush on. I was never that kind of athlete. Yes, I swam, but I was never that way. And it just brought back 17 and high school and the angst in the most intense ways, but fabulously written. It's also not long. It's a pretty short book. So that's my sports book.
Wow. I need to read that.
I know you do.
It sounds really similar to The Knockout Queen by Ruphy Thorpe.
Yes, but not as dark.
Similar themes of like female athlete body image stuff.
Exactly. But there was the other character in The Knockout Queen, the boy. And there's none of that.
Okay.
It's just her. So what's your choice?
So the key for sports books for me is to be 5 stars, they need to be about a lot more than sports. And I think the good ones usually are.
Mm-hmm.
So 100% my favorite sports book is Beartown by Frederick Bachman.
I agree. I love it.
But that's all over the place. So I'm going to bring you another one. I'm going to bring you Trophy Son by Douglas Brunt. It's a little bit more under the radar. It's set in the world of elite/professional tennis. The main character in the story, his story has huge similarities to Andre Agassi's story, the very overbearing tennis father, that kind of stuff.
Oh.
And this sort of combines the elite sports setting of You Will Know Me by Megan Abbott with the father-son dynamic of The Great Santini by Pat Conroy. It's an indictment of the world of overbearing sports parents. It's also about the psychological and emotional side of professional tennis and probably any professional sport, to be honest, and the experience of a young and totally ill-equipped man trying to figure out who he is when all he's ever been is a tennis ball hitting machine. So I loved that one. Trophy Son by Douglas Brunt. That was 5 stars for me back when I read it.
I need to read that because I do like sports books.
This is my favorite question that was submitted of any of these. And it is, what are your favorite books in your least favorite genres? You did not like this question.
I was going to say, it's my least favorite. Just because the answers that come to mind are some of the same titles and genres that I think you're probably going to talk about.
So I was going to ask you, if you and I picked 2 genres for this, they were the same genres. Did you do that just because I had chosen these genres? Or did you, these are actually your least favorite genres?
They're my least favorite genres that I've ever attempted to read a book.
Okay.
I mean, you know, you could say Western, but I've never read a Western.
Well, right. So like a middle grade's not a genre, I guess, but
right.
Like I don't even have a pick for that because I have not
exactly
read anything, right?
No, I'm going to go with horror. And my choice is The Road by Cormac McCarthy. And I loved it for the same reason I love a lot of books. When an author is able to immerse the reader in at least 2 wildly different emotions. In this case, it was the horror of a post-apocalyptic world against the tenderness of a father's love for his son. So to be able to be terrified and even repulsed and heartbroken at the same time, I'm not going to forget that. That's an easy 5 stars, but I don't read a lot of horror. I just think that book is absolutely stellar.
I've got a horror pick too.
Okay.
It is Fantastic Land by Mike Bachoven. It is a story about what happens in an amusement park after a massive hurricane hits and the mostly teenage emergency skeleton staff stays on site. And they are unable to be rescued for weeks. So there's a big Lord of the Flies vibe.
Right. I was going to say, wow. Okay. Wow.
Yeah. One of the reasons I love this is because I feel like horror so often veers into the supernatural, and this did not. And I also loved the structure of the book. It was told interview style. So not quite an oral history, but it felt like an oral history a little bit. Like each chapter was a different perspective of somebody else involved, either somebody on the ground in the amusement park or somebody on the rescue team. I think there was one by somebody in the media. I just love that kind of structure.
Okay.
My other genre, and I almost took it out because it's romance. And the reason I almost took it out is because I feel like I'm starting to get a handle on this a little bit.
I think you are.
Yeah. I have like 5 books to share for this question for romance.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm starting to figure out what will work for me in a romance and then what types of romance to stay away from. So I can't fully say this is a least favorite genre anymore.
Okay.
But I'll just reel these off quickly. I've talked about them on the show multiple times already. One to Watch by Kate Stayman London, who was a guest on the show. 7 Days in June by Tia Williams, another guest on the show. Red, White, and Royal Blue by Casey McQuiston. American Royals by Catherine McGee, but not as much the follow-up book to that.
Agree. Yep.
Which I can't remember the name of now, but I did not love the sequel as much. And then The Charm Offensive by Allison Cochran, which I have talked about on a bonus episode for patrons.
Okay. See, I've read most of those and I agree with you.
Yeah. The romance has to deal with some deeper, more serious issue in the book that has nothing to do with the romance.
Right.
It might maybe impede the couple's ability to get together for a period of time or something, but there has to be some other issues that are being addressed in the book.
Agreed.
And it can't have cheesy banter.
Well, gosh, you're practically leading right into the next question.
Yes, I am. I am leading right into the next question.
Good segue.
Which was totally unintended. What is an immediate turnoff that will keep you from reading a book? Catherine, we've got more than one each, by the way. I could not just put one.
No, neither could I. It's also a question that's going to make me come off as judgy, but I'm sorry.
You come off as intellectual with your answers.
Well, if you're reviewing books, you're judgy by definition. It's the whole point, right? My number one, I do have number one now that I've said all that, bad writing. If the sentences don't flow smoothly, I can hardly articulate it. But bad writing, inattention to detail, and repetitive descriptors. So that is...
Repetitors, descriptors arguably constitute bad writing too.
Yes. No, you're exactly right. They are like whatever, a subgenre. But
right.
You've got to tell me... whatever, 15 times about a character's green eyes using either the same words, I'm done. I don't care. They're green. So that's one. And then I am just also going to say, because it's kind of coming up a lot lately, but certain types of book covers.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
I know we're not supposed to judge a book by its cover, but there's a book out right now that a lot of people are reading and pushing.
What is it?
Vladimir?
Oh, yeah.
And I don't care.
Yeah.
I feel like the cover is pandering or playing to a stereotype. Even if they're going to flip the script, I don't care. So the cover can make me sometimes take a pass on a book. But that's me. How about you?
I don't care at all about book covers.
Really? You're so good.
Either positive or negative. I think because I read on a Kindle so much.
You know what? That's probably true. Yes, because you don't see them that often.
They can be signifiers for me of like the type of book I'm going to get. Mm-hmm. But I don't really care. I don't ever go gaga over a beautiful cover either. I don't ever pick up a book because it had a beautiful cover.
Oh, I've done that at times. Hell, I pick out wine if I like the label.
Well, no, I do that. Pretty. It's because I don't know a lot about wine, so might as well pick it up by the label.
Well, what are your turnoffs with books?
I think these would probably be not that surprising to anybody that's been listening for a while, but magical realism.
I know. That one makes me sad.
I know. I can't get my head around it. Although a few books that handle it very lightly do work for me. But Ghost and really anything in the supernatural paranormal realm, kind of for the same reasons that magical realism is hard for me. Books that are described as sweet or charming.
That's a tough one because, yeah, I agree with you. I'm there.
Yeah.
But sometimes, and it's happened recently, I read a book that is just it's the best word. And I don't know. I think tone can come into place.
For sure. And then I have one more, and that is flowery writing. Mm-hmm. I don't mind very simple, like almost easy writing. That doesn't constitute bad writing for me.
Oh, no. Right.
Yeah. Flowery writing, I cannot do.
Okay.
All right. What makes a book an easy read in your mind?
Well, it ties back just to the previous question, and that's good writing is always a given. But easy reading for me is likely to be what used to be called chick lit and is maybe now known as contemporary women genre, and that's lighter subject matter and entertaining. A novel where I don't have to think, the author does all the work. It's one of the few times in my life I don't mind being bossed around. You know, feel this, feel that, believe this, no triggers, manageable controversy, and all neatly wrapped up at the end. And as examples, I would say I think of Ellen Hildebrand, Sophie Kinsella, and Jennifer Weiner are three authors that I think kind of fall into that category.
You and I are different on this.
Okay.
So you said, let me make sure I got your words right. Did you say no triggers in there?
Yeah.
Okay. So for me, an easy read is all about the writing style. Easy to follow, goes down easy. I don't care if the subject matter is tough.
Ah.
Like I can read a really just heart-wrenching memoir. If the writing style is easy, that feels like kind of an easy read to me.
Interesting.
And like I can read pretty dark books, like a dark thriller or something like that, that's written in an easy way, and that still feels like an easy read.
Actually, you know what? Now that you say that, Sarah, I can see that because like immediately, Steve Kavanaugh.
Yes, totally.
Okay.
And I want to say there is a limit. Like Honor by Thridi Umrugar is so far beyond dark and emotionally tough. That's not an easy read for me. The writing style was not simple in that either.
Mm-hmm.
But to a certain extent, I can read some pretty dark things that feel easy to me.
I understand that. That makes sense.
All right. Very last question. There are very few books where the main characters, and the person that wrote this question also said slash detective in particular, is 65 or 70 years old. Can you suggest any? Catherine.
Well, I think both of us are going to land in the same space on this. I don't have a detective answer.
Same.
Okay. I don't have a detective novel, but here are just three books with what I'll call senior narrators that I absolutely loved. Our Souls at Night by Kent Haroff.
Loved that too.
Marguerite's Harbor by Eleanor Morse. And The Spectator Bird by Wallace Stegner, which that was published, I don't even know, in the 70s. But you can get it. It's a classic. And it's absolutely beautiful. Those would be the three that came immediately to mind. How about you?
I've got two. Lillian Boxfish Takes a Walk by Kathleen Rooney. And this is an 85-year-old woman who is walking around Manhattan, sort of reflecting back on her life.
I loved that book.
I loved it, too. She lived a cool life. She was the highest paid female advertising executive in the country in a time when there weren't many female advertising executives. And then her career ended early for all the reasons that many women's careers end. And she's just sort of reflecting on that whole thing. And then Mothering Sunday by Graham Swift. And this is a really short book, too. Like, I think under 200 pages, maybe, or maybe just over. But it's about a former maid at a British estate who also is reflecting back on the illicit love affair she had with the heir to a neighboring estate when she was a young maid. And it's gorgeously written, and I love how it talks about sort of the evolution of women. That's Mothering Sunday by Graham Swift. And those are our superlatives today. Y'all, if you liked this format today, you can get access to monthly superlative episodes by supporting the show on Patreon, either at the $5 or $7 level. These episodes are available to both levels. And there's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio. And in 2 weeks, March 23rd, we are going to be going behind the scenes of ghostwriting with Barbara Feinman Todd, who is the former ghostwriter to Hillary Clinton and Bob Woodward. Talk to you in 2 weeks.
Thanks so much for listening to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. You can find show notes with all the books mentioned in the episode, purchase links, and linked timestamps at www.sarahsbookshelves.com/podcast. And that's Sarah with an H. I'd love to hear your comments, feedback, and suggestions. You can find me online on my blog, sarahsbookshelves.com, on Twitter at sarahsshelves, on Instagram at sarahsbookshelves, and via email at sarahsbookshelves@gmail.com.
And if you'd like to get exclusive bonus episodes of the podcast, you can support us on Patreon at www.patreon.com/Sarah's Bookshelves. And there's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio to my Patreon page. Thanks for listening.